in Bangalore, if people did have ideas, they did not have a space that would nurture it, which meant with tools, machines and mentors. These are the three fundamental things for somebody who can practice making and build stuff, right? And prototype.
Julia is your own personal robotic cook. It's a smart kitchen appliance that cooks food for you automatically. All you have to do is choose a recipe, load in the necessary ingredients into containers specified in the app, tap cook, and it cooks a food from start to finish.
And so they wanted me to, you know, tell a few stories. And all I did was, see, I couldn't possibly mentor them because most of them are three times my age. Okay. So the first time I went, this is how they introduced me. She may look, all small and young, but then don't go by her looks. Listen to what she has to say. Okay, so that's how they introduced me. And I think that was a great experience. I mean, that is where I did not really feel very happy when we won all these awards and grants. But there, when I was actually, trying to tell them my story, and after my sessions, a girl came to me and told, hey, I was all down and out till today, till I heard what you were telling. But I think now I'm on a whole new level.
Hello, everyone. My name is Neil Patel, and thank you for downloading the Best of the Indian Startup Show. First, I would like to pay tribute to everyone listening and subscribing to the show for the past 4 years. Without you, this podcast would not have been possible. Over 750,000 downloads, so I'm very, very grateful. Thank you. So today you will hear from Anupama Gowda, the co-founder of Workbench Projects in Bangalore. She talks about building a makerspace for tinkerers, artists, makers, engineers, and anyone with an inspired spirit. Next up is Raghav Gupta, co-founder of Nimble Labs. He talks about creating a curry cooking robot, freeing you from your kitchen. And finally, Nivedita, she's the co-founder of TrashCon. She's on a mission to solve India's huge waste management problem. So sit back and enjoy some of the best moments of the Indian Startup Show. Thank you.
Hello, Anu. Thank you for coming on the Indian Startup Show today.
Thank you, Neil.
Okay, please tell the listeners what you do, please.
So I'm part of a makerspace and a fab lab based out of Bangalore. So it's quite an interesting journey for us to nestle a space like this, which meant to reclaim a public space in the heart of the city. Mm-hmm. And we're right under the metro station in Bangalore. So it's quite a story for us to tell.
How did you get started then?
So we have two fellow founders. One, my partner, happens to come from mechanical engineering background, mm-hmm. Somebody who worked with 3D systems in the US and had spent some time there. And I come from art practice background. I used to work at the Barbican Arts Centre in London very briefly. I came back in 2009. Mm-hmm. And at some point in 2011-12, we kind of stumbled upon one another's work while we were trying to prototype something for an educational services company. So which meant that we were trying to explore teaching mathematics to students in their early years in a very tangible, more accessible, meaningful way with contextualizing to their everyday realities of the things that they do and the experience in a city that they live in. Mm-hmm. So while we were trying to prototype that, what could have ideally been achieved in 1/4 of its time, we'd taken almost 12 months, a year to prototype it. Mm-hmm. I think that phase was a learning phase for us to understand that in Bangalore, if people did have ideas, they did not have a space that would nurture it, which meant with tools, machines, and mentors. These are the three fundamental things for somebody who can practice making and build stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And prototype. So I think we decided at that point, after finishing that project, that no more looking otherwise. We would just become enablers for people who have such ideas to come and prototype without any hindrance. Mm-hmm. And that's how Workbench Projects actually started out of a garage, my father's garage, in really some remote part of Bangalore. But I think with time, we were able to make a very compelling case the city much wanted it. And we chanced upon an association with the government to bid for a public space mm-hmm. in the heart of the city. And we won the bid. And ever since then, we've been right under a working functional metro station.
How's it going so far? How many members or makers do you have?
On an average, month on month, we do have quite a bit of floating population. Mm-hmm. We have both a maker space as well as co-working space that's fully operational. At any given point, we have around 35 to 40 members, I could say. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes we do a low season is something like 25 to 30. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that what you expected when you first started in your dad's garage?
Actually, in my dad's garage, everything was experimental. Oh. Even the idea was experimental. You weren't very sure whether even people would subscribe to it, right? Because it's still very nascent in India for people to get back to making. Mm-hmm. You know, you've taken some of these things for very easily granted because India is also a very strong service sector country, right? Mm-hmm. So I think we're still midway. The journey is quite long ahead. And so far, so good.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Can you give examples of like courses or workshops that you do or how it works, basically?
So we are quite a demographic neutral space, right? And also very sector agnostic, mm-hmm. Which would mean that we try to encourage makers who come from clearly home-based practice. Mm-hmm. So it could be even my mother who could come in as a homemaker, mm-hmm. who always wanted to build a table and a chair, mm-hmm. gets access to tools, machines, and mentors to maybe even build her own dining table. Mm-hmm. I don't know, right? So it could be something as hands-on as woodworking, mm-hmm. to say somebody who's really exploring robotics, say electronics, physical computing. So the varied things that one offers. And we try to partner and collaborate with many other facilitators in the city, mm-hmm. so that we can build this platform a lot more stronger. Mm-hmm. And so you will see people who are interested in running workshops with vertical gardening,
okay.
to Arduino, to say jewelry making. Mm-hmm. So it's a range of things. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excellent. Do you have any like favorite projects or can you share some success stories that have come out of your makerspace?
Yeah. I think two very interesting stories really strike of our space. One initially happened to be from somebody who is a practicing architect and also teaches in one of the very well-known architectural college based out of Bangalore. Mm-hmm. He hails from the coastal belt of Pondicherry. So this is a very prominent tourist space as well. And he was very sensitive in actually looking at building low-cost housing, affordable houses, and was also trying to see whether he could really use tidal wave energy so that he could harvest for domestic use. Such that it's built into the house, mm-hmm. so that at least 15% of the domestic use of that energy could be harvested from the tidal waves in the coastal belt itself. So it is it's called Blue Wave Green Energy Tech, mm-hmm. Which this member of us eventually patented and went into the market and is doing great. So I think that's one story that really keeps coming back to me. And the other story, which is quite interesting, is a product that was conceived by somebody who is from the veterinary sciences background, mm-hmm. and who was able to identify a problem in his own practice, saying that the traditional stethoscopes really do not do justice to reading the vital signs, particularly of the animals he treated. And he was very keen to, bring a team together and put together the first electronic stethoscope. And of course, it went on to the crowdfunding platform, and it's called Thal. Mm-hmm. And Muse Incorporated was started out of Workbench Projects. And of course, they've moved on and stuff. But these two stories, and of course, there are many more if one had to speak about. Which I do think we've been enablers for such things to at least get started. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, things are going well then. What would you say like the biggest challenges then? What keeps you awake at night then?
I think a space like this is not very easy to generate revenue because I think we've also put our own strengths as our own limitations, you know, because both the founders are very, very driven to responsible innovation. And the primer is that we want to keep enabling work that will be meaningful for the larger benefit of the society. And of course, you know, you do trade off when you take up consulting, you rent out your space and stuff. But it's not very easy to sustain a practice and sustain the operational costs of a physical space that demands a lot of upkeep and maintenance. So when you are running a startup without any funding from anyone, such that you want to bootstrap it because you're very ideologically stuck on the fact that you do not want to sell your soul to the devil, you know, and you want to also see that the purpose with which you've started should not be lost, mm-hmm. right? And I think for us to sustain that rigor mm-hmm. has been the biggest challenge. But I think we're figuring things out now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sounds exciting. I believe you're getting involved with the Hyperloop, if you can just explain that, explain more to our listeners.
Right. Hyperloop, particularly Hyperloop India project, which was a collective of student body of multidisciplinary students from various colleges, very reputed colleges from across India, had actually done their homework well and were already part of the first grand challenge of the Hyperloop Global Challenge. Mm-hmm. And I think there were around 1,200 teams that had applied. And these boys had already made it through the first round. Mm-hmm. And they happened to be one of the 24 finalists who were invited by SpaceX, the guys who laid out this 1 mile track to test the technology, where our Indian boys were able to, take that forward, given that they were keen to use our facility to physically prototype this scaled-down version of the pod. So it was not just us. It was many people in the ecosystem based out of Bangalore, particularly the industrial belt with our connects that the boys happened to build this 4 meters by 1.5 meters by 1 meter pod, which is like almost the scale of a sedan.
Sounds exciting.
Which was built and shipped to LA to test. And yeah, it's just on its way back to India now by sea. Well, yes.
Did you get any feedback on how it went?
Oh, yes. I mean, we were, sadly enough, we were not the top three who made it through the challenge to go into the vacuum chamber. But we were certainly recognized for the compact electronics and the feasibility and the scalability in design. And I think the boys have done a good job and they're furthering their research in that direction. Mm-hmm. Yeah. To say, I think they're also working on several projects, these boys, who still college students, okay. right? Yeah. And so we were just enablers to help them get that pod ready and move there to run it at the SpaceX facility.
Hyperloop then, is it hype then or is it going to be real then, do you think? What your opinion is?
See, for me, there are two views to this, right? Hype in one sense, I do agree, because coming from a very developmental sector, the mindset is that, there are many other things that, as India, that we should be addressing. And getting from point A to point B, if it's going to be really helping change the dynamics of, say, the operations of lesser-known occupancies in smaller towns to the cities, I do believe that this is going to be a phenomenal change, right? And the hype part of it is like, yeah, I mean, you really need to see the proven technology, right? Because all of us are experimenting with it. Somebody wrote the white paper sitting in the West, but cracking that technology isn't that very easy. So I think it will take us time, but for me, the very reason we supported a project which is so futuristic in time and talking about the fifth mode of transport was to enable and also to ensure that students, regardless of whether they are still within the academic confines with their limitations, who dream to make things happen, should be provided that platform. And the second thing that I always believe is that we should not fear to fail, you know. And this project is a testimony to that, that we were trying to help enable students to gain that confidence that needless to be supported by the academic world or the, you know, non-academic spaces. Mm-hmm. If there is a purpose and there is an interest, everyone has to be provided that fair chance. Mm-hmm. So I think for us, the Hyperloop is still a futuristic technology. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad we were tempted. And I do see that there could be real possibilities because Hyperloop 1 has already started some initial discussions with the state government of Karnataka mm-hmm. to do its pilot. So it certainly is seeing some light of its day, I could say. Mm-hmm. It's certainly seeing some direction.
Yeah, watch this space.
Yeah, we just have to be keenly watching it.
I believe you're doing a maker fair next month, if you can tell our listeners about that.
Yes. So this is our commitment that annually once we try to encourage the community as much as possible to come, share their work, showcase their work and celebrate the movement. And we started out with the Maker Media's license because that's a time-tested event mm-hmm. world over. And this is our third innings, I could say. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is the bigger and the better, the mega fair that we are hosting with the support of the Karnataka ITBT Ministry. So we are seeing a lot of work happening at ground level because we've done some extensive traveling to look for makers across the state and some across the country as well. So we're quite excited, actually, about the upcoming fair.
How many people turned up last year then?
Last year, it was a one-day event on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. We had nearly around 4,500 footfall. Mm-hmm. Yeah, through the day of around 8 hours. So that was quite... And of course, in India, number isn't an issue, right? But it's also about the quality of the fair. I think hosting it as an independent fair with, as a startup, I think we did a great job last year mm-hmm. putting it together with our own challenges. You do know how the limitations are, but still, I think we did justice to the fair. But this year, yes, there is a lot of support in terms of the government showing its commitment and promise. Mm-hmm. So certainly there is an appreciation for, what can I say, amateur makers. Mm-hmm. So I think this is going somewhere in the positive direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about you then. Mm-hmm. You said you've got an arts education background.
Yes, yes.
You know, a lot of people I speak to have engineering backgrounds, IT backgrounds, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why art?
So my formal academic training has been in history of arts and then gallery studies and critical curating. Mm-hmm. But what I really enjoyed in my entire academic training was to see the convergences of the arts with mainstream practice. Mm-hmm. So I think for me, every work that I do is through the lens and through the entry points of the arts. So when I said earlier that we were trying to build something that was extremely physical and tangible to experience mathematics, mm-hmm. it was about the cross-disciplinary function of how do you bring the arts to speak with science to speak with the math, mm-hmm. you know? And I think the process in which one arrives at building these two things, you know, bringing the many disciplines together is the exciting bit for me. Mm-hmm. So with the current facility, what I try to do is I engage largely with educators and students because art is a great enabler to experience digital fabrication mm-hmm. or be it the sciences. And it has a very strong place that, what can I say, mitigates a lot of ambiguity in individuals. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, I'll tell you the last project that I worked on. I worked with a group of community children in Halsur, mm-hmm. The place where we work out of. Mm-hmm. And what I was trying to achieve was these are natives of that particular vicinity who come from a very strong Tamil background, mm-hmm. which is a very regional identity. So we were trying to retrace the history of that locality by putting together a digitally fabricated leather puppet show.
Oh, okay.
So which meant that, A, I was trying to give them an experience of retracing history. B, I was trying to give them an understanding of what is traditional leather puppet making, right? And C, the attempt to see how technology can interface with traditional practices, to see how machines can do the same job very differently and much more precise, and allows the student to play with technology in a very different sense. So it was never to introduce the children to technology in a very force-fitting way, but to put that in a very seamless fashion of, you know, the arts coming with technology and experiencing the two and taking on, you know, the real spirit of making. So it's left to the child eventually, you know, how he's going to use the technology going forward. How would he really take on to 3D modeling, be it on Google SketchUp or, say, using other softwares. But and also understanding the science behind how a laser machine would work, right? So these are the kind of interfaces that I'm more excited and interested in. I mean, I would really like to constantly work on.
What are your what are your favorite pieces of art then?
I must say I'm a very figurative composition lover. So I love something that's very Indian in nature and figurative and narrative. So I do appreciate a good Mysore traditional piece of painting. To somebody who in the contemporary practice like Ramesh Gorjala, who's appropriated the Ramayana in the best of its way that I can imagine. So I think I'm a more Indian contemporary figurative person with a very strong backing of mythology and text and narratives.
Excellent. Let's talk about the team then. I'm looking on the website, you have a colonel who works for you?
Yes, we have Colonel Vinod Prasha, yes. So I keep telling, when I told you about running a space for a very demographic neutral audience, I also mean by practice keeping the space very active with people with very youthful thinking. So if you really come and see our space, two very senior members of our staff, one happens to be Balu, a man who is a lover for wood and machines that really do magics with wood. You know, he works on wood and trains people with wood. So the entire woodworking studio is run by the senior gentleman, right? That's Balu. Now, bringing the capabilities of a retired army officer is to put in a bit of discipline and a sense of administration for a space that is literally quite chaotic otherwise, you know, and I think this is what I say magic, you know. How do you bring people from different backgrounds but yet to speak to one another in a manner that one can appreciate one another's skills and find their way in a place that is so maddening?
It's quite it's quite impressive. He's like a paratrooper stroke international hockey player.
Oh yes. Yes, it is true, but and I think that will continue to be the spirit of the space.
Okay. Well, last few questions then. What advice would you give someone who has an idea and wants to bring that idea to a prototype?
I think this is in another interview that I gave, and I keep repeating that often, that, you know, if you really have an idea, stay invested in it enough to jump and deep dive into it, you know. I always say that that's why the word incubate, it's as good as giving birth to that child, right? So for that, you really need to preparedly ask yourself, how invested are you in that idea? Because often I see that people lose a lot of patience given the trajectory is not very positive sometimes, you know, because with any idea that you come up, you have 99% of them saying that it's a wasteful idea. So, I mean, how do you really beat those odds with your own real homework, right? So you need to be convinced with your idea from the get-go, which means that you need to have incubated that idea in yourself to do enough research to begin with, even before you deep dive. So I think that's one thing that I always tell anybody who comes up with an idea. Because it's very easy to float off ideas, and there are zillions of people who are like idea hoppers, but that really doesn't take them anywhere. Sadly enough, they don't complete it, and they let the others start from an unfinished job, you know. And what could have been done right at the very get-go, I think people will try to demystify it in the wrong sense, you know. So why do you leave room for that? Either you do it right and be invested, or just don't do it at all, because there might be someone else who's worthy of that idea and to put that idea to meritorious work.
Do you have any heroes that you look up to, or any influences?
Influences in the ecosystem, or it's just general?
In general, yeah.
Who do I really look up to? I mean, should it always be somebody who's very famous?
So someone who's probably been an influential person in your career or life.
For me, that's I think for every girl, it's always the dad. Okay. You know, the father is the image, you know, because he's a true believer in what you do. And he's always willing to tell you that, you know, sweetheart, first you try and attempt, you know, failing is the second part. And it's always there to stand for you, you know. So I think for me, it has been my father, who's always been around and who supported my madness through and through. Because it's not very easy for somebody from the arts background to conceive and run a space such as Workbench Projects, which is a very technically backed organization, right? So to stay invested in it, it's also about the faith that one has to go every day through the rigmarole to say that, hey, I understand little, but I'll understand better today, you know, and even better tomorrow. So I think that drive has come from him, I think.
Hello, Raghav. Thank you for coming on the Indian Startup Show today.
Thanks for having me over, Neil.
Yep, super excited to talk to you today. Please tell the listeners what you're building.
So at Nimble Labs, we're trying to make it possible for all our fellow listeners to conveniently eat healthy home-cooked food every day through the use of domestic cooking robots. Cooking every day is a big, big problem. I needn't elaborate on the problem. People are leading busy lifestyles. They're growing up not knowing how to cook, and are increasingly choosing to eat outside from takeaways and from restaurants every day. So the first appliance we're building is called Julia. Julia is your own personal robotic cook. It's a smart kitchen appliance that cooks food for you automatically. All you have to do is choose a recipe, load in the necessary ingredients into containers specified in the app, tap cook, and it cooks a food from start to finish. It stirs for you, it cooks for you, it puts in the right ingredients at the right time, in the right quantities, and using a bunch of sensors, monitors your food consistently, so it comes out perfectly.
How did you come up?
What happened was that my co-founder, Rohin, and I would often hang out together. Some of those days, we would go back home, and my co-founder would go back earlier. And I would ask him why, and he would tell me that he had to cook. And when I asked him, you know, to explain to me further about it, he told me that that now he and his sisters had started helping their mothers out for dinner. Mm-hmm. So they would cook dinner while the mother would cook lunch. Mm-hmm. Now, one of those days, he came to me and he said he had this idea that we could just probably automate cooking. He wasn't sure of it, but he explained that, you know, most of the cooking process in India, at least, is pretty standardized. You have an onion tomato curry paste. You have a bunch of spices, and on top of this, you add a main, which could be chicken, which could be paneer, which could be a whole bunch of vegetables, or it could just be dal. But the process is pretty standard and something that could be standardized. And we started working on it, and it just worked out. That's how we started.
Mm-hmm. So is this in the market then? You know, how many have you sold, and you know, what's the price?
So we haven't started shipping yet. Mm-hmm. We're in fact in the research and development phase. Mm-hmm. So we have a fully functional prototype, but it still needs more work on the cleaning issues. Mm-hmm. On it needs to satisfy OEM requirements so it can be produced in bulk. Mm-hmm. And we still need to improve the user experience. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Okay, cool. When do you think you're going to launch this product then to the excited world?
So we plan to do a pre-sales campaign in October 2018. Sorry for that. Yeah. So that's where we plan to launch our product out, and we would be shipping around April 2019.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So are you a patient person then? That's a long time to wait, right?
Yes, that's a long time to wait. But unfortunately, hardware takes time. Mm-hmm. Even Tesla had to wait number of years before they could take their first car out. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And same for other smart kitchen appliances out there in the market. Mm-hmm. The beloved Roti-matic, for example, it's a kitchen appliance that cooks rotis for you. Mm-hmm. It took them 8 years to develop. Mm-hmm. But once they shipped, it was nothing like it. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Okay. And why is it called Julia?
So we just like the name. Mm-hmm. We like the personality. We thought the appliance should have a personality that could that showed that it was intelligent. It was not another equipment in your kitchen like a juicer or a blender. It was someone or something that listened to you and cooked for you to your liking.
Mm-hmm. Who's this actually for then? Who are you actually targeting?
So we are initially we shall be targeting most Indian and Asian communities in the West, mm-hmm. primarily because unlike India, where we have easy access to domestic help, mm-hmm. That is not the case in the UK or the US. Mm-hmm. Gradually, we also start selling in India as people get familiar with the idea of appliances cooking for you. Mm-hmm. And to the world, because one-pot meals are things that can be cooked that form a main part of the diet for a large variety of the population.
Why are you doing this?
So we're really doing this because we feel that healthy food is something which everyone should be eating. Mm-hmm. And it's not something which is very easy to prepare on a day-to-day basis, especially for my generation, for example. We grow up eating food cooked by our parents, our mothers, mm-hmm. And we never dirty our hands in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. When we go out into the world, we start working, we really forget about our health. We eat whatever is available out there for 50 rupees or less. But once we get married, right, things start changing. Mm-hmm. We have to start worrying about our families, about our children, about our wives. And, none of us, neither would my wife know how to cook. And it needs to be something that takes care of our daily cooking. Mm-hmm. So really, I'm doing this for myself and for my generation and for
your future wife.
really, my future wife.
Cool. This sounds quite a risky prospect. I mean, are you a risk taker?
Yes, I am a risk taker, but we also take risks in a calculated fashion. Mm-hmm. So it's a risk, but at the same time, it's a big problem that needs to be solved. And if not us, then who would do it? Mm-hmm. I mean, the world has been shaped by risk takers. Mm-hmm. Everything that you see around you, all the physical products that you see, or maybe even the software that you use, mm-hmm. was the result of someone taking a big bet, mm-hmm. on solving a problem that no one was solving. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Who are your favorite risk takers then?
So you've heard, probably you know, one of the favorites of everyone is Elon Musk. Mm-hmm. Elon Musk has taken, you know, large number of big bets, sold PayPal, and started a space business which he had, which he knew nothing about. Mm-hmm. Took over a car, an electric car business again, of which he knew nothing about himself. Mm-hmm. And again, transforming transportation, electrification, sustainability in a manner, space travel, that nobody had ever imagined. Another one of my favorite risk takers would be a friend of mine from Australia called Brendan Baker. Mm-hmm. Really admire him. Again, started from nothing, even flunked in school. But now, through his bold risks and determination, he's—it's just that he's making a life for himself in a way that I'd never thought of. Mm-hmm.
I believe this company's been incubated at the Bosch DNA Startup Accelerator Program.
Yes. So what happened was, we started our company last year in June. And our first attempt at solving the cooking problem was a robotic arm, mm-hmm. that could cook food. Good for us, Bosch took notice in December last year and invited us to shift our base from New Delhi to Bangalore. Mm-hmm. And that's where we started working with one of the largest appliance makers in Europe, mm-hmm. to build our kitchen appliance. At Bosch, we changed the design of our prototype completely. Mm-hmm. From an industrial robotic arm, it now became a coffee maker like of a machine, mm-hmm. a coffee maker kind of a machine that could go in your household and not scare you. Mm-hmm. The size got reduced a lot. We got to see how big corporations work in building these appliances. Mm-hmm. The mentorship was invaluable. And most importantly, we got exposed to the startup ecosystem of Bengaluru, mm-hmm. which is the startup capital of India. Before coming here, I had never known what was meant by an ecosystem. We would just read it in the news, in the papers, but experiencing it firsthand was what I got to know when I moved here to Bangalore as part of the Bosch Accelerator.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think you got into the Bosch Accelerator then? Because obviously they must have a lot of companies that apply.
About 600 companies applied, and Bosch chose about 10 to go ahead with.
Why do you think you got in then?
I think part of the reason was that the problem we were trying to solve was very big. Mm-hmm. It was something that even experts at Bosch could see. Bosch also realized that it was a business that it could, it would also want to venture in the near future. In fact, there are also investors in Rotimatic,
okay,
which again is using robotics in domestic households. Mm-hmm. Plus, the progress that we had made in such a short span of time, 6 months, was huge. And Bosch wanted to know how startups work so fast, mm. and how they could employ those practices in the corporate structure that they had created for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would you say is the best advice you received at Bosch?
The best advice that we received was that consumers do not really, consumers just want their job to be done. Mm. So when we built our first proto, we were not paying attention to the consumer's needs as much as we were paying attention to the technology. Mm. And at Bosch, we realized that not everyone might want a robotic arm occupying so much space in their household. That was not one perspective that we had had. A person might find a robotic arm in his household very scary and unsafe. Mm. Those are things we as engineers had not thought. So it was really the perspective that gradually opened over a period of time that we value at Bosch. Mm-hmm. If I had to name one single advice, it would be very difficult for me to pinpoint it. Mm-hmm.
What was the best thing about this accelerator then?
The best thing about the accelerator was that it helped us go as fast as we wanted to, but in the right direction. Mm-hmm. So I think we were like the plane, we were like a pilot in driving a plane at super fast speed, but probably in the wrong direction. And that's what Bosch helped us with. It helped us steer that plane in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. So is life getting easier for you then, or harder?
I think it never gets easier. And once you start selling, it gets all the more harder. Mm-hmm. But getting associated with Bosch being associated with Bosch has made things easier for us, which earlier were difficult. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, has introduced us to more aspects which are difficult. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I'm sure over the days, those things will also become easier.
Mm-hmm.
So very recently we were covered by Bloomberg.
Oh, okay.
So we had never, if we were not associated with Bosch, I think it would have been very difficult for a team to fly in from Europe all the way to India to make a 3-minute video on on our cooking robot.
Mm. Excellent.
The press takes us much more seriously. There is much more credibility. Yeah. To the story. Mm-hmm. It has made fundraising easier. In about 2 weeks from now, we will be battling on CNBC India.
Oh, wow.
For a funding of 1 crore rupees. Mm-hmm. on TV. We have also been selected as one of the top early stage startups in the state of Karnataka in India. Mm-hmm. And shall be receiving a generous government grant, which shall be handed to us by the chief minister himself on 18th of November this year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Emotionally, how do you feel about all that then?
Emotionally, there are highs and there are lows. Mm. Whenever we achieve a milestone, all of these things were targets that we achieved.
Mm.
We get super excited, and that's the reason I feel those milestones are very important. Mm-hmm. But then there are days when you're being rejected by investors, when you're being rejected by potential employees, by potential customers, because it takes a lot of iterations. That's when you feel low. There are times when a potential employee would just not respond to your emails at the last minute of, closing them in.
Mm.
That really takes up an emotional toll on our brains. And then another important thing is that being a startup, we have limited resources and have to plan for a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
So unlike a corporation where you have different people handling over different things in the business. In startups, we have to be lean and devise strategies not just for product development, but for marketing, for distribution, for fundraising. And all this has to be done by a very small, lean team.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That takes an emotional toll.
Yeah. What would this business look like in 10 years' time, you think?
In 10 years' time, I think there will be economies which share food amongst themselves. Mm-hmm. And when I say share food, I mean imagine a future where you can cook a recipe on smart devices, upload the recipes just like software code,
mm-hmm.
for others to download it on their systems and on their devices which cooks it exactly the way, you know, you cooked it back at your home. Mm-hmm. So just like 3D printers have made it possible for one to replicate physical devices, I think similarly people will be able to replicate food. So instead of watching a YouTube video of your favorite chef, you will just be able to download his or her recipe and have your devices cook it exactly the same way.
Oh, wow, exciting. Well, what's your favorite food then?
I like curry chawal a lot. So curry is an Indian dish, pretty famous in the north. So I like that cooked by, you know, the hands of my mother. And I think if we can replicate that, and I'm in Bangalore right now. If I could just have her send that recipe to me over the cloud, and if I could cook it over Julia, well, nothing like it.
Excellent. What's your least favorite food then? Anything you don't like?
No, there's no least favorite food. Okay. I think I can eat anything as long as it is vegetarian.
Okay, that's cool. Excellent. What does your friends and family think of this, by the way?
My friends and family have been very supportive over the last 18 months or so. They see strong potential. Our relatives keep pushing us to develop this as soon as possible. They say if this can solve our cooking problems, well, keep working on it. So our family has been a family of business people. So all my extended family, from my father to my uncles to my aunts, are business people. And they realize that great businesses are built by taking those chances, taking time, and they've been very supportive.
I believe you went to China and Hong Kong. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so very recently we went to China, specifically an area called Shenzhen. So Shenzhen is the mecca for hardware startups. It's the place where everything is manufactured, from your TV remote to your TV to your iPhone itself. So it's really an eye-opening place. Why we went there was to identify potential manufacturing, prototyping, and sourcing partners. Just like Silicon Valley has expertise for software, Shenzhen is a place where you have chips, literally Texas Instruments or Qualcomm chips, being sold in bulk by vendors on the street. And if I had to find the camera of my phone, even in big offices in India, I would not be able to find it. So why we were there was primarily to identify those sourcing partners. And we plan to prototype some of our subsystems in China, surely because of their expertise and their speed. So that's what brought us there. At the same time, there's something called Canton Fair. Canton Fair is, in a way, the world's largest trade fair. And that, again, is held in China. There are people from all over the world flocking to do business. And they're very open to business. Even the way you do business is very unique. You don't spend, more than 2 minutes with a particular manufacturer. You just go, say hi, tell them your requirements, exchange your car, and move ahead. It's so big.
No small talk.
No small talk. You don't sit on a chair to discuss these specifics. You only do that once you're back home.
So how many people did you speak to then?
We probably spoke to over 200 people.
That's amazing.
Right. And we've been doing the same with not just vendors, but also with our potential customers. So we've, again, talked to over 100 potential customers. And I think that part is also very, very important for a startup to do. Often what happens is, I think you also are a technologist. Often what happens is that we as technologists get so engrossed in our technology that we think it's the perfect solution for people out there. And if we talk in terms of economics, you know, there's supply and demand. And entrepreneurs in India, at least, as I've come to see, are more focused on the supply side rather than the demand side. Mm-hmm. And for entrepreneurs, I think it's very important to focus on the demand of getting the right, of getting your target segment right before you start building whatever you're building.
Mm-hmm. How much will it cost?
So Julia should cost $300 and upwards, mm-hmm. Depending on what variant you want to buy. Mm-hmm. So and that's how we intend to price it.
Mm-hmm. How did you come up with that price?
So we did an extensive study. As I told you, we talked to a lot of potential users. Mm-hmm. We told them what all Julia could do. We showed them videos. We also did our back of the head bill of materials costing. Mm-hmm. And that's how we came up with the number. Mm-hmm. However, that number can vary. It can change. Mm-hmm. So that number is our preliminary estimation by talking to customers and from our own engineering calculations. Mm-hmm.
Okay, last few questions then. Let's say someone's listening and they want to do what you do. What advice would you give them?
I would ask them to just like... Ganesh from FluxGen had advised mm-hmm. On the podcast a few weeks back, I would advise them to be patient. Mm-hmm. Patience is key to building a sustainable business. I would advise them to spend more time out of their offices and their rooms. I would advise them to travel because traveling opens up your perspective like nothing else. Mm-hmm. I would advise them to talk to as many people as possible, especially people if they fall into your customer segment. Mm-hmm. I would advise them to not be stingy about equity, mm-hmm. To be generous with equity when they're getting people on board. I think that's about it. Mm-hmm. That's all the advice I have.
What are your favorite products?
So I love Dyson. Dyson is, for those who are not aware, Dyson is a manufacturer and a designer for vacuum cleaners, for hair dryers, mm-hmm. and a whole lot of other consumer products. Mm-hmm. So I really love the work of James Dyson and each and every product that they built. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of thought, work, and time has gone into their product. Mm-hmm. For example, I don't know if you've seen their new hair dryer.
Yes.
Or even their fans, you know, their room fans. Mm. They're unlike anything that anyone has ever built. Even the vacuum cleaners, for that matter, they're using technology that no one had even thought of, and they perform surprisingly well. So Dyson products are some of my favorite. And I think the other category is, of course, products built by the world's most valuable company, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which is Apple, mm-hmm. of course. So those two companies, I think, I really value.
Hello, Nivia. Thank you for coming on the Indian Startup Show today.
Yeah. Hi, Neil. Hi, everyone.
Please tell the listeners what you're building.
What we are building is a machine called TrashBot.
Yep.
And TrashBot is a bot which can absolutely do any kind of segregation of mixed municipal solid waste. Mm-hmm. And when I'm talking about municipal solid waste, this is the waste that is, otherwise found in front of your houses, dumped in the streets, or, getting burnt in the landfills. So what this machine essentially does is take this waste and segregate it into biodegradable waste and non-biodegradable waste. When you're segregating any kind of mixed waste, you're generating value out of it, and the way this machine does is it is almost instantly, it does it instantly and with an accuracy of almost 98%.
Excellent. And where did you get the idea from?
Yeah, so I'm a chemical engineer, mm-hmm. and I'm now 22. Mm-hmm. And during my, during my second year of, engineering, I happened to pass through this one street near my institute, mm-hmm. where absolutely no one could pass through because it had this huge dump yard, and everybody, all the residents used to come and dump their garbage in there, and nobody used to clear it. So what we used to do was take the entire long route because we couldn't, take the sink. Mm-hmm. So one day it so happened that, I was done with it, and even the residents there, some of them I knew, and they were complaining how some of them were falling ill and they couldn't bear the stink that was coming out of there. And so I thought, why not do something about it? So as you know, I had all this NGO background and etc. So I used it, and we started something like a campaign. Mm-hmm. Went, approached the mayor and the chief engineering officer of that place, and they appreciated the effort, and eventually we cleaned up the entire area, the government authorities, the entire, we students, a group of students and the residents. So that was all cool. We actually did the campaign very well. The place was clean. We came in the newspapers, all well. Mm-hmm. But then 1 week later, almost the same thing, occurred. I mean, I went through the same area and again, the same dump was there. Then I realized that, all this bringing about a campaign or bringing about a change is going nowhere, because all of us are just self-sufficient as long as the waste is out of our houses. Mm-hmm. But then what happens to it later on is where the question is. And until you segregate waste, you cannot actually generate value out of it. And although almost 40 million rag pickers are trying to generate segregate waste across the nation, we hardly have 10% segregation. Can you imagine 10% segregation? Mm-hmm. And we generate around 42 million tons of waste every day.
Every day.
So when you're generating such a quantity and you're only segregating 10%, then the amount of waste that is sitting in the landfills is absolutely enormous. I mean, Neil, to be frank, I have been to a few landfills, and can you imagine the amount of waste that is sitting there? Mm-hmm. It's 1 lakh crore tons.
Wow.
Of waste that was sitting in that landfill. And when I was approaching, I felt it's a mountain. I really mistook it for a huge mountain. And then I end up seeing that, yeah, it was a huge landfill. So when that is the case, I felt, that there is a need. Mm-hmm. There is an absolute need for technology to intervene, because otherwise, there is no more area left to dump waste anymore. Say, if you take US, for example, the population is very less. So maybe that is not creating a direct impact already, but it will eventually in the future. But if you take a country like India, the impact is readily seen. All these, the floods that occur, clogging of the holes in the roads, all of this is but a consequence of the waste being dumped on the streets. And the main crux of this problem is not doing enough segregation. So that is why, very fueled by this entire idea, I thought, let us come up with a technology to do it. And when we began it, everybody, we were a group of three, and I went and pitched into my professor, and she was very glad, that we were coming up with something like this. But all the experienced experts in the field told us, hey, that's not possible. I mean, you are a bunch of 21-year-olds. I mean, what can you possibly do? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't crack something of this magnitude, right? So, but then eventually, I think 2 years of hard work, no Saturday, Sundays, complete R&D, a lot of failures. Mm-hmm. And at last, I think we hit the right thing. Mm-hmm. And we came up with our first prototype. And that is when I realized, oh, there's a huge economic value also that we are generating. Apart from the social, impact that we are creating, we are also generating a huge economic value. And that's when I went ahead and, started knowing more about this field, and then that's when the product became a hit. I mean, now we have huge traction. Mm-hmm. We are known across, I think, many embassies also apart from India. Mm-hmm. So I think we have gained a huge traction even without any kind of marketing. We already have launched one product where we are currently segregating around 140 houses waste, and it has been running for the past 1 month. Each day we have around 100 kgs of waste that we are handling, and now we are releasing version 2 of TrashBot, which is of a higher capacity, and which we plan to give it away to the municipalities, because a few municipalities have approached us and have invited us to put up our machines in their wards.
Seems like you've been on a roller coaster journey for the last 2 years then.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it's been just 3 months since I graduated. Yeah. And it's a real, I mean, we are already there amongst the top 100 most innovative. I mean, you see that in our website as well. So we have had a couple of, you know, achievements and achievements that we abnormally a 3 month old startup cannot actually, you know, even imagine. And I think that is very much because we have hit the right pain point at the right time. So I think that is all. And I mean, even the government of Karnataka has been supporting us a lot. They have, you know, funded us. They have actually incubated us. So it's a pretty good thing that way. So a lot of support. I mean, I have never faced a no from anybody so far. So yeah.
How does the machine actually work then?
So we have understood that, you know, using sensors or any kind of machine learning or image processing can maybe do segregation of mixed waste, but it cannot do it at a capacity that we intend to do. I mean, you know, in the range of tons per day. So then we realized that the go-to solution is mechanical unit operations. So a sequence of mechanical unit operations placed in a compact way is what does the trick. So we have the waste being, you know, dumped from your dustbins directly into the hopper of the machine. The hopper is basically the feed where you put in the entire waste, and the waste gets shredded. And when you're talking about shredding, it gets shredded into very fine particles. And the shredder is very unique because generally the kind of shredders you find is very particular. Say you find shredders for bio waste, you find shredders for wood waste, but you won't find a all-in-one shredder, you know, which can shred absolutely anything. So this shredder does that particular thing. Before this, you have sub-stages where you remove metals and, you know, non-metals such as aluminium. That is done using a magnetic or eddy current separator. We generally don't use it because in household waste, we haven't found much of a metal content. It's hardly 0.03% of waste. So, you know, the metals that we are talking about. Then when it gets shredded, it goes through a pneumatic separation. So pneumatic separation is wherein you use air as the medium of separation for biodegradable and non-biodegradable. So the biodegradable being denser falls closer to the, you know, axial blower that we are using, and the non-biodegradable falls farther apart. So the novelty of this whole thing, I mean, we have a patent on it. The novelty of the whole thing is that the sequencing in which the mechanical operations are placed, the different, you know, specifications that the entire machine works on. I mean, what is the exact velocity that you should run the blower at? What is the pressure that you should be running it at? And what is the feed that you can feed in? And what is the output that you're getting? So we have ensured that we have optimized this to an extent of up to 98%, as I told you. And with every machine, I think we are just making it more and more user-friendly because our users are mostly people who are unskilled. So the machine is also built in a way that, you know, any person can use it. You know, anybody. You don't need to literally be trained. I mean, we train them for a week or so, but then after that, they can take care of it themselves.
Mm-hmm. What happens after the waste has been separated then?
Yeah, so when you segregate the waste, the bio waste that you get is a very good material for being used as compost, you know, or to be sent to biomethanization units. So in biomethanization units, what is currently happening is that most of them run under capacity because as you know, that their main, you know, source of waste is from central kitchens or hotels, which are very less in quantity. So if you have, say, a 30-ton plant, which one of our partners have, they hardly get around 5 to 10 tons every day. So that is where you can, you know, we are trying to supplement all of them because they're currently going in lower margins because of segregation not happening up to the mark because they need at least 85% of biodegradable to be fed into their machine. So anything less, they cannot accept. So that's how the, you know, bio waste is taken care of. Now, the non-bio, when you're looking at it, that we are creating a new market out there because the non-bio that we are getting is predominantly plastics and they are shredded mixed plastics. So what happens is that this does not find a ready value in the market that we're currently having because currently they manually segregate, right? So all the bottles go to one place, all the, say, cans go to another place. So we are shredding everything and saying, hey, see, the non-biodegradable is shredded. Now, we have found that it has multiple uses. Number one being you can mix it with roads. You know, bitumen, 9 tons of bitumen is mixed with 1 ton of plastics to be paved on roads. And that ensures almost 6 times lifespan of the roads, which most of the municipalities have taken into. I mean, across the world, this is being followed. That is something that all of us know about. So we have tied up with one of the road construction industry for the same, wherein we are thinking of supplying the next few tons of plastics to them. Mm-hmm. Second, we are trying to find applications in composite making, as in if you take wood or plywood, for example, you can actually make lesser cost but similar strength, you know, wood furnitures or wood utility products by mixing it with plastic. So plastics basically reinforce the material, anything, you know, that you mix it with. So that is number two, you know, where you can find usage. Three is wherein we have gained enough, interest from companies such as Shell and Bosch, and they're definitely interested in our product. And Shell, as you know, has a plastic, you know, waste to fuel plant. Mm. So one more very important utility of the non-biodegradable is you can convert it into fuel. Say diesel, you can convert it into diesel. That is something that we're looking into.
Mm-hmm. Seems everyone's really positive about this business that you're doing. What can go wrong? I mean, do you have any like sleepless nights or anything that you're worried
about? I mean, Neil, now I'm giving you the solutions, but then maybe 2 years ago, it was an impossibility to almost everyone except us who were dreaming big. And down the lane, we have understood that, you know, nothing can actually be impossible. And that's when I hit a lot of roadblocks, like say this non-biodegradable, shredded non-bio. I think I would have gone to around 50 recycling units, and all of them told, hey, the kind of waste you have is something that I can't even understand. What are you even talking about? So essentially, that was a roadblock. But then eventually, I mean, we kept hitting it so hard that we actually found a way through it. And that's when we found all these few channels that were available in front of us. So I think there is more to go. I mean, there are more challenges, and every day is absolutely a different day. I mean,
what kept you going in the early days?
I had a lot of belief in my product. I mean, that was a very important thing, because I felt that more than the product, people were buying into my passion and my belief in my product. You know, product was secondary. That's something that I understood over this period. And I also felt that, you know, I was very inspired, because I really wanted to bring about a change to this entire industry. Because I've been in close contact with, you know, these rag pickers who are currently using their bare hands to do segregation. And I wanted to bring them to the main field and, you know, channelize their participation in the society in a better way. And also the entire community as a whole. I mean, I would not want to have waste dumped in front of my house. And I just wanted to bring about a change. And I just can't sit and, you know, lay back and complain, you know, bring about a change. I mean, cause something. So yeah, I think that's what kept me going. I mean, I wanted to do it. That's it.
What's the business model then? Is it going to be a profit or non-profit? Will you be
No, it is going to be for profit, obviously, because I think we are, we have two models. One is wherein we sell the machines, and we sell the machines to a few customer segments, such as municipal corporations, to, you know, all these huge IT parks, to educational institutions and apartments with more than 3,000 households. So this is basically a huge market, as you can imagine. And also to our partners, you know, say biomethanization units and composting units, wherein they can, you know, put in all the waste that they're getting in and actually segregate bio and non-bio and take the bio out from there. Currently, these industries have employed around 300, 400 people to do the task which one machine could do. Mm. So that is what we are trying to look at. You know, they're having a recurring cost here, and here one machine can actually do the entire thing, and within almost one-tenth the time that the people take to, with obviously less number of errors. Mm. So the second model is leasing, where we lease out the machines to apartments with less than 3,000 households. Mm. And that, for them, we give an end-to-end waste management, wherein we take the waste, we sell the waste to our partners in the bio and non-bio segments. So that is another thing. So we sell the machines, we sell the waste. So there are two things. Mm-hmm. And we already have around 4 pre-orders when it comes to apartments. And we have gotten calls from Gurgaon, from Delhi NCR region, from Chennai, and many other places for, you know, the machine. So I think now we have more demand than we can supply. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where we are now.
Emotionally, how do you feel about that then? The fact that you got more demand than supply?
I think I felt that there are more challenges ahead. Emotionally, I'm not really overwhelmed, although I think I just feel that, you know, we need to increase more capacity. And currently I'm on the roadmap to find out how is it that we can, you know, increase our capacity to, you know, fuel the supply.
How are you finding being a CEO? Because obviously you're you've been a student and an inventor, now a CEO. How are you finding it?
Yeah, I think me being a CEO is not something that I am. It may look to the entire world that there's one girl who is, you know, trying to do this. Mm-hmm. But behind me is a set of, is my team, is a set of mentors whom I have. And I think it's because of all of them that I've come to where we are now. So I'm not a single person army who's running the show. Mm-hmm. A CEO is just the name. I'm just a person who's giving ideas and trying to, you know, take things forward. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a whole, army behind who is trying to, push me ahead. So I think there's not much of a responsibility with all these people there.
Yeah. What excites you most then about what you're doing?
I think every day is exciting. I mean, I feel that even if TrashCon really becomes big and I feel all settled, I'm not going to really feel good because I want every day to be, getting every day. I get up early in the morning and then I have like 100 calls and, 100 things to look into and hundreds of challenges. Mm. And everything is new, I mean, everything is new. You cannot really get it out of a few books. Mm. So you need to think out of the box every day and find a way out. It so happens that all these challenges, the first time you hit it, you feel like it's a roadblock. I mean, you can't go beyond it. And that's where the fun lies. Because if it was easy, that's how we motivate ourselves in our team. Mm. We tell if this problem was easy, then maybe anybody could have done it. Mm-hmm. And because it's difficult, it's our duty to solve it. So, yeah, that's what pushes us out.
Actually, so, many startups do fail, but, you seem to be doing well. What are your thoughts on that? Why is that, you think?
Neil, I think the most important thing is that the team should have belief in the product that they are giving to the world. And that is most important because the customer is not really going into a startup or a company, or even if you say investors. I mean, we have a lot of investors who are interested in our, in funding us. I mean, currently we have funds from the government of Karnataka, and we have also, we are also going to receive funds from IIM Bangalore. Mm-hmm. So we are quite sufficient as of now. But apart from that, also, we have investors who want to invest in this venture. But the reason behind all this, I think, if I can sum it up, is because we do not give up. We do not really give up very easily. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what sets us apart. And and people know that, if they have come this long, if they could come up with a product that was otherwise impossible, they can absolutely go ahead and make it big. You get it? I mean, that's the proof we have. We have already set our foundation very strong. Mm-hmm. And maybe that is the belief that people get mm-hmm. out for us.
Cool. Let's talk about you then. What's your background? You said you were
right? I'm a chemical engineer from RB College of Engineering in Bangalore. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. I was more into, social activities. I was a lot into co-curricular activities back in college. Mm-hmm. And that is how, and I always was of the plan that, right after college, I need to have, or even when I was in college, I always used to brainstorm new ideas for a venture. And somehow, we always used to do, I think I participated in most of the B plans, won a few, and that's how the foundation was built. And eventually, when we felt that this is the idea, I think nothing could stop us. I mean, that's what happened. And I think we have, I think that's pretty much it. I also, as of now, I don't have any hobbies because I don't get time. So, yeah.
Excellent. And you also are a mentor at the Founders Institute.
Yeah, so Founders Institute invited me to, give a few sessions because I was the youngest entrepreneur mm-hmm. Whom they felt has, done something that that has set a mark. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted me to, tell a few stories. And all I did was, I couldn't possibly mentor them because most of them are three times my age. Okay. So the first time I went, this is how they introduced me. She may look, all small and young, but then don't go by her looks. Mm-hmm. Listen to what she has to say. Okay, so that's how they introduced me. And I think that was a great experience. I mean, that is where I did not really feel very happy when we won all these awards and grants. But there, when I was actually, trying to tell them my story, and after my sessions, a girl came to me and told, hey, I was all down and out till, till today, till I heard what you were telling. Mm-hmm. But I think now I'm on a whole new level. Mm-hmm. I really feel that I have all the strength to take my venture ahead. And I think that's where the entire change happened. I really felt that, wow, if my story could inspire people, that's something. So yeah.
When they ask questions, then what is the main question they ask you then?
So they ask me, how was it that I gained so much traction? It was mostly regarding how I built my product from a prototype. How is it that I got enough support to build it? How is it that I gained financial support to build it? And most importantly, how is it that I raise investments? All these questions were what was, you know, generally asked. And I generally spoke on gaining traction only, because so far we have done zero investment on marketing and you know what is the status that we have now. Mm-hmm. So yeah,
okay,
that's what they wanted to know.
Yeah, okay. So obviously we have listeners who want to do their own business. You know, what advice would you give them?
So to begin with, I think point number one, age, qualification, or the status where you are now doesn't definitely matter, because I'm a 22-year-old coming from a very middle-class family with nobody in my background having even 0.1% idea about business. I mean, all my family is either are either public servants or people who are doing employees. So I think that's where you need to break the ice and come out and know that, no, if you do have a great idea and if you believe in it, the world will come forward to help you out with it. I mean, there are a lot of peers who are in my age group who feel that this is not the right age. Maybe I can try after I have an MBA or say an MS and then maybe have my own venture. But I really think that there is no right time. It is the time when you feel it's right and you need to go ahead with it. So yeah, that is one advice I would like to give, because I have seen a lot of my peers having great ideas and not going ahead only because of this inhibition in their mind. So that is one thing. And secondly, believe in your product. When you're pitching in front of anybody, the one and only thing that they're going to look at is the passion that you have and how much you believe in your product and the positivity that you radiate about the product. And that's what pulls people around you, and that's what makes people flock around you. So yeah, these two things are what I can say at this point of time. Daniel.
So you've come up with a lot of ideas. How do you actually come up with ideas? You know, if people are listening, they seem to have stuck on what to do next. Once they come up with an idea, what would be the next stage? Say if they come up with an idea.
So I think that's a good thing, because Neil, you know what? I mean, when we started with this particular idea, right? And we came up with our methodology and our entire simulation of whatever I told you. When we went and pitched this in front of a few people, they told, hey, if you have done it, somebody would have already done it, right? I mean, this is one huge inhibition that all of us have. If I have got this idea, that means somebody else would have also got it. So what's the point? I mean, what am I? I'm just a 21-year-old, whatever, however you limit yourself. In fact, people told us you may not get a patent. I mean, this is something that people have done. It's so simple. I mean, I could have thought about it, but that's where the difference is. You know, I could have thought about it. They did not end up thinking about it. So what we are doing is very simple. And that's why when people look at it, they tell, hey, this innovation is something that I could have thought of. And that's what kicks them, you know, in their belly. Shit, why didn't I think of it? Right. So I think that's where when you get an idea, you shouldn't really give it up. Ideas do come. When you see a problem, you have the mind goes about brainstorming about a solution. And then you have that solution. I think we should not just give it up right away by saying that, hey, somebody may have this idea. Maybe there's already technology about it. Maybe there's already an alternative. Why not think, let me go ahead with it. Let me look at whatever is available. And whatever is available, why not find out a better way?
So at the moment, you're sort of like doing the prototype stage and people are using it. When will this go into mass production then? What are your thoughts on that?
So it's already, we have already set it up in an apartment. So we are going to launch the version 2, which is the version that is going to be, that's a market-ready product in the first week of December. So we are already calling all these, and we have around 4 apartments whom we will be supplying by this year end. So starting next year on, we are thinking of going into, not next year on, quarter 2 of 2018 is when we are thinking of going into mass production. That is maybe supply around 10 to 20 machines per month. But that needs appropriate infrastructure, and that requires a lot of investment. So we'll be raising it then and then going ahead.
Okay, cool. Last few questions then. Is anyone you admire?
So yeah, there are a lot of people whom I admire, and most importantly, I think when I was growing up, it was my mother, because she was a very independent lady. Mm-hmm. She's the one who told me when I told her, I got placed okay in my initial years of engineering, and I told her, hey, I got placed, and that's a huge thing, right? I mean, I was the first person to get placed from my department, and I told my mother, and she wasn't really happy. She told, let's see. I told, why aren't you happy? I mean, any mother has to be happy. And she told, no, that's not what you are meant to do. I mean, you're meant for something higher. And she always knew that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. And we, as I told you, we come from a very middle-class background. She didn't have enough financial system to support me. But she told me, I'll fund you as long as you want, because I want this entire inhibition of coming from a middle-class family, being a young person, and you cannot have a business, to absolutely vanish, and you be an example for that. So I think, yeah, she was a huge inspiration throughout until now. And apart from that, I have my mentors, whom I always go look up to, because they have been there and done it. And yeah, so I learn from almost everybody at different walks of life. Let's say right from my fabricator to everybody. I don't really inhibit myself from asking questions, however dumb they are. So yeah, I think most of the people in my life have turned into an inspiration. I can't really name one person.
That's good. If somebody wants to do what you do, how do they get started?
So I think first thing is find out what is the idea, what is the problem that you're trying to solve. Say if it is waste segregation, then let's hit upon it. And then look at what is the capacity that you want to solve this problem on. Say you can go, there are companies that are doing waste segregation, they who do 2 tons per month. They are also trying to solve the purpose at a different scale. And there are those who are trying to, segregate around few thousand tons per day, and they are doing it at a different scale. What is the scale that I wish to, solve this problem at? And when you zero down on that, then we go ahead and, try to ideate what is the best possible way to do it. And then you'll have a couple of, ideas out in your mind. So I think the best way to do is go about, start talking to people, start talking to the industries in this field. That's what we did. Almost 6 months, we went around, kept talking to people in this waste management industry, understanding what problem are we actually trying to solve. And once you understand that, you'll get a lot of insights, which I'm sure that otherwise we would not get in any literature that we are going to read. Mm-hmm. I mean, a tremendous amount of insights you'll get when you go into the market, step out, and then talk to the people who are actually doing it. And then when you learn it from them, use those insights to actually formulate the solution that you're trying to build. And when you formulate a solution, do not wait for the right time to, get the right amount of money and then start. I mean, somehow beg, borrow, steal, get the money, do it, make it happen. However horrible the product may look, just do it. I mean, first thing, it's going to give you a tremendous amount of satisfaction. And secondly, you will have a proof of concept ready. And when you have your proof of concept ready, I think that's the time to, start optimizing and understanding how you could actually make it into a prototype and then develop it into a product. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's the way I did. Mm-hmm. So
And work weekends as well.
Oh yeah, definitely. There's no Saturday, Sunday. I mean, it's been a long time since I actually partied. My friends have actually thought that I'm being really rude because I missed almost every birthday, every party. So, this is how I tell them, hey, I'll launch the product too, and maybe then we can party. Or maybe I'll start generating revenue, I'd say this much, and then maybe we can party. And then they've given up on me. So.
That's the end of the show, and if you liked it, please leave a rating and a review of the show. Just search for the Indian Startup Show on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Acast, Lumery, and Castbox. If you are building something exciting, please send me an email, hello@neilpatel.co, or tweet at IndianStartupSH, or go to facebook.com/IndianStartupShow. Love to connect. Thank you and goodbye.